Hello, I'm doing something very unusual for me, which is recording a speech to be played back later. It's a rather strange experience not to have an audience anywhere in the world when I'm actually speaking, so I'm going to have to try to pretend to myself that I have an audience now. It's a strange thing. It shouldn't matter, but it does. I'm going to start by explaining what free software is all about. Why did we start the free software movement? When I began programming, I became part of a community of programmers who cooperated with each other, who shared software. If you had a program and your friend would like a copy and asked for a copy, of course you give it to him. And that was not just the executable, but the source code as well. It was normal to have the source code for the programs we were using. With the source code, the program is not a black box. You're not stuck with it exactly the way someone else set it up. You have control. You can study what it does. You can learn. And you can change it to make it do exactly what you need or exactly what you want. This way of life was a very good one. It was a way of life where people could help each other. People could treat each other like friends. But actually, it wasn't really so unusual. There's something else very much like it in another area of life, in the area of cooking. If you cook, most likely you use recipes. And you've probably had the experience of getting copies of recipes from your friends. And maybe you've copied recipes and given copies to your friends. You've also probably looked at a recipe to see what the ingredients are to make sure there's nothing in there that you or your friends shouldn't eat. And you may have changed a recipe because you're not required to follow the recipe exactly the way it's written. You could leave out the salt because your doctor said don't eat salt. You could add mushrooms because you love mushrooms. All sorts of changes you can make. And there's something else that's a bit more unusual. If you cook your modified version of the recipe for your friends, a friend might say, hey, that's delicious. Could I have the recipe? Then if you want to take the time, you could write down your version of the recipe and make a copy for your friend. So here we're talking about making and distributing copies, studying the recipe, changing the recipe, and distributing a modified version. The exact same freedoms that we in my community of programmers used to enjoy when we cooperated in using software. Imagine if somebody tried to say that you were not allowed to study a recipe or change a recipe, or make a copy for your friend. But if you did those things, you were a pirate, and they would put you in prison for years. Imagine the outrage that everyone who cooks would feel if governments tried to take away their freedom to do those things. That's exactly what I felt when my community of cooperation, of cooperating programmers, came to an end. And I saw myself facing the prospect of using non-free software, software that you can't study, can't change, and you're not allowed to share. I felt so much outrage that I said, I refuse to accept that way of life. That way of life is no good. I'm not going to live that way. Instead, I'm going to make an alternative. I'll do whatever it takes so that I can keep using computers and live in freedom as part of a community where people can help each other. If you use a program that is not free, then you have been divided from the rest of your community. So in order for us to live in freedom, what do we need? We need to have free software to do every job. Every job we want to do on the computer, we've got to be able to do it and still keep our freedom, which means we've got to be able to do it with free software. The first collection of software you need is an operating system. My field was operating system development, so I decided I would start by developing a free software operating system. With an operating system, you can use your computer for many different purposes. Without an operating system, your computer won't run at all. It's just dead weight. So the operating system is not everything. It's not all the software you'll ever need, but it's the first thing you need. So it was worth developing the operating system first. I decided to develop an operating system compatible with Unix for technical reasons. At the time, I had never used Unix. I had only read about it. But what I read told me it would be a good model to follow. It was a portable operating system, so if I followed the design of Unix, I could make another portable operating system. And that was an important thing. It would take years to develop a free operating system, and I didn't know which computers would be popular several years in the future. This was in 1983 when I was thinking about these plans. I figured it would take till maybe the end of the 80s to have a complete operating system, and that would be time for various things to change. So I decided to follow the design of Unix, which would make for a portable system. That way, whatever computers were popular in 1990 and 2000, we could still support them. And then I looked for a name. Now, the community I come from, in this community we call ourselves hackers. And what we mean by that is we enjoy playful cleverness. It actually has nothing to do with breaking security. Whatever we're doing, whether it's programming or life, you know, we want to look for ways to have playful cleverness. And part of that is we look for funny names for the programs we write. So I decided to make the name for this system a recursive acronym. The name of this system is GNU. And GNU stands for GNU is not Unix. So when people ask me, but what does the G stand for? Well, the G stands for GNU. And I think that this joke works in Portuguese more or less. You could say GNU não é Unix. Please forgive my bad pronunciation. I've never studied Portuguese. So, once I had a name that was funny, then we could start the work. And in January 1984, I started developing the many programs that you needed to put together an entire Unix-like operating system. Because that system design is composed of many different programs, each program doing a particular job, and they work together through standard interfaces. Nowadays, these interfaces are called the POSIX standard. In those days, there was no official standard, but being compatible with Unix meant using the same interfaces. So, throughout the 80s, I and then the other people I recruited were writing these various programs, and we put them together. In the early 90s, we had almost all of the GNU operating system. One important piece was still missing. That piece, that gap in the GNU system, was the kernel. During that whole time, I was constantly looking for shortcuts, looking for some existing piece of free software that someone or other had written that we could use as part of the system in order to shorten the path so that we could get a complete system sooner. And I was hoping we would find a kernel or part of a kernel somewhere. In 1990, we found part of a kernel. We found the bottom part. It's a microkernel known as Mach that was developed at Carnegie Mellon University. So we decided to write on top of this bottom part, the microkernel Mach, we would write the GNU herd, which was another collection of programs, And together they would do the job of the kernel of Unix, the Unix kernel. It took many years for us to get that done. And in the meantime, another kernel was developed. It's called Linux. The Linux kernel was developed by Linus Torvalds in 1991. Originally, it was not free software, but he changed the license in 1992. He released it under the GNU General Public License, which is the license that we had written to use on most GNU programs. It's not the only free software license. There are many free software licenses. It's the license we usually recommend because it defends the freedom of the software for all users. Most free software licenses permit non-free modified versions, and that means somebody else can come along, take the free program, and make an improved but non-free version. And the users, if they don't value freedom, they might switch to the non-free version, and that means a step backwards for freedom. With the GNU General Public License, we can actually use copyright law so as to prohibit modified non-free versions. What we say is, you can take our code and make a modified version, and you can publish the modified version if you choose. But when you do so, your modified version must likewise respect the user's freedom. So this way we never find ourselves in the unfortunate position of having to compete with somebody else who takes advantage of all our work but won't let us use his work. That's a pretty frustrating situation to be in. And the other free software licenses, most of them, allow that to happen. In any case, Linux was released in 1992 under the free software license that we had written. At that point, it was possible to take Linux and fit it into the gap in the GNU system. And this combination, the GNU plus Linux system, then began to catch on. And it achieved the goal that we set out for in 1984, the goal of a free, completely free, Unix-like operating system, which made it possible to get a computer and run it without ever giving up your freedom, without ever installing a program that says you are helpless, you are forbidden to share with your neighbors. In effect, we had built a new continent in cyberspace, away from all the lords of software who kept an iron grip on the software that existed. We built a new continent where people could go to live in freedom. And much better than the new world, our new continent, because it was built, not found, there were no indigenous peoples living there that we had to steal it from, and there's room for absolutely everyone. Every one of you can live in freedom if you make the effort. You just have to replace the non-free software on your computer with free software and decide, from now on, I'm living in freedom. When the GNU plus Linux system caught on, people discovered that it had technical advantages too, that these various programs that composed the system were very powerful and they were very reliable. People found that the GNU plus Linux system would keep running for months without a crash. They'd say, it only crashes when I have to turn the power off. And they found it was a very powerful system too. They could make it do exactly what they wanted. And, of course, one side effect of people's freedom is that you can get copies for a low price as well. So it was cheap to operate. So it had many practical advantages. And you know, in technical fields, there are a lot of people who don't think about freedom, ethical and political issues. They're focused narrowly on how to get a job done efficiently. So they picked up the GNU plus Linux system and said, this is a great, powerful, reliable system that's cheap to operate, but they didn't mention it's a way you can live in freedom. So the GNU system, in its Linux-based version, became very popular. Tens of millions of people are using it, but most of them never mentioned the most important thing about it, which is that this is how you can live in freedom. And the result is, many people assumed that the whole point of the system was to be popular. There are thousands of people who consider themselves fans of the system. Most of them call themselves Linux users or Linux fans because they think that the whole system is Linux. That is a confusion that got started in 1992 or 93. Many people started thinking that Linux was the entire system, so you will probably find many people who say that they are Linux users or that they have a Linux machine running or that they're using a certain Linux distribution. And really what they mean is that they're GNU plus Linux users and they have a GNU plus Linux machine running, or they're talking about a certain distribution of the GNU plus Linux system. In any case, they think that the whole point of this software is to be a success. They think that the most important thing is just to have more people using this software. They've forgotten the real point, which is we should be living in freedom and we should have the freedom to treat each other decently. And so you find people who put on a show which is dedicated to free software. And they have companies presenting non-free software. Now this is the exact opposite of what we should be aiming for. The software from Oracle and Microsoft is non-free. If you use that software, your freedom has been taken away from you. Those companies won't give you a copy unless you promise that you will not share with your neighbor. And that is an immoral promise. It's a violation of social solidarity. You should never do that. If you do that, you're putting yourself in a moral dilemma. Because as soon as your friend or your neighbor or even a stranger comes and says, "This is a nice program, could I have a copy?" Now, all of a sudden, the moral dilemma hits you. What are you going to say? You have a choice between two evils. One evil is, share with this other person. He deserves your help. Share with him, but then you're violating the license, the contract you agreed to. That's not right. And the other alternative is, obey the contract and refuse to share with this other person. That's not right either. You're going to have to choose the lesser evil. And the lesser evil is to share with this other person because he deserves your help. And anybody who asked you to promise not to share with the rest of the world, that person does not deserve your help. He doesn't deserve to have that contract carried out. So that's the lesser evil. But really, when you should anticipate this situation, you shouldn't just sign this contract and later on say, "Oh, what a surprise. Now I have to choose between two evils." You should, when you are offered that program, you should recognize then that that program is a path to a moral dilemma. And at that point, you should say no. You should say, "If I accept this program, I will be forcing myself to choose one evil or another later on. So I am going to do no evil. I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to say no to this program from Oracle or Microsoft or Adobe or any of those companies. I'm going to use only software that I can freely, openly share with the other people in the world who may ask for my cooperation someday." So these companies that are sponsoring this event today, they are the exact opposite of what this event should be working for. And some of them are actually making speeches here where they're going to try to completely mislead you about what this is all about. They paid for that privilege with their money. But if you don't recognize that freedom is the goal, that a decent ethical society where people can help each other is the goal, you might think there's nothing wrong with this. There are people who thought that the availability of Oracle's non-free database on the GNU/Linux system was a contribution to our community because it would make the GNU/Linux system more popular. And that's true. It may make the system more popular, but it represents forgetting what the whole system's all about. It means confusing means with ends. Instead of aiming for freedom, we are settling for mere popularity. There is no more important thing we have to do to make sure freedom triumphs than to remember the goal, to remember that freedom is what we need and remember what it means. Life constantly offers opportunities to discard your freedom. Someone will come along and say, give up your freedom to me and I'll give you something convenient. In the United States, Bush said, give up your freedom and I'll make you safe from those terrorists. And we lost a lot of our freedom. The worst blow that my country has suffered in many years was struck by its own leaders in response to the September 11th attacks, supposedly as a way of protecting us. And it's always like this. Freedom is never automatically secure. If you want to keep your freedom, you have to defend it. But in order to defend it, you have to value it. And in order to value it, you have to know what it is. That's the first step. And that's what I'm speaking to you about today. So, when a state government in Brazil would like to do something to support the free software movement, that is very good. That motivation is good. But it's important to do it in the right way. Not by supporting an event managed by a corporation and operated as a trade show where companies that make non-free software are invited to come and present it as if it were ethically legitimate, but rather a true community event that focuses on the goal of moving society out of the trap of non-free software, out to the path of freedom. One where the goal is not confused and cluttered up and hidden by companies presenting a contrary goal. So I hope that the government of Paraná and other state governments will recognize the lesson of this attempt, and next time they will do it right. Because there will be more opportunities. One event is not everything. Next year, they can do it right. And they can help start to move society, move the computer users of Paraná and the rest of Brazil to freedom. The most important step for doing this is to switch to free software in schools. Schools are the most important place for any government to adopt free software. Sure, adopting free software in public administration, that's good too. Everyone ought to use free software. Government agencies ought to remain in full control of their own computers. They have a duty to the citizens to maintain control of their computation on the citizens' behalf. And that means they must reject non-free software. But schools are more important. There are four reasons why it is essential to switch to free software in schools. I'll present them from the most superficial to the deepest. The most superficial reason is to save money, because the licenses for the software used in the schools is a big drain, and schools never have enough money. This drain is holding them back. Even in the richest countries, schools don't have enough money. In Brazil, they certainly don't have enough money. Now, Microsoft may offer schools a gratis copy of Windows, a zero-price copy of Windows. It won't be free. It won't be free software, but it might be zero price. It's a terrible mistake to accept that. It's like accepting gratis packs of cigarettes for the children in the school. It's a plan to get them hooked, to make them addicts for when they are adults. So even if temporarily they will let the school avoid paying money, remember that there are more important reasons too. The second reason, moving towards deeper reasons, is why schools should use free software is to train adults who are users of free software. Because if the schools train people to become adults who use non-free software, then they have built up dependency in society. Society is dependent on the constant flood of money. I think it's around $1 billion a year now for Brazil, to a few rich foreign companies. And this drain on society is a terrible burden. So schools should teach people to live the life that is good for the country's health. That means train them to use free software. Of course, the non-free software companies understand this too. That's why they offer zero price copies of their non-free software to the school. They want the school to train students to be addicts. And it's the school's responsibility to recognize this too and refuse to do it. The third reason for schools to use free software is for education's sake. You see, non-free software prohibits education. Non-free software is the opposite of education. It says you are not allowed to learn because everything inside the software is secret. When students are in their teenage years, some of them become fascinated with machinery, with software. They want to learn everything. And these are the people who are going to become the great programmers. They are the natural-born programmers. And all you have to do to enable them to become great programmers is give them free software and say to them, you can learn anything you want. It's all exposed. Nothing is secret. Because they're going to want to learn about the software they're using. They'll, type the commands to do something and wonder, how does the program do this when I give this command? If they're using non-free software, the answer is, it's a secret. You're not allowed to learn. You're not allowed to learn anything. All you're allowed to learn is how to run it. You're supposed to be ignorant. But with free software, the school can say, the teachers can say, oh, you're curious, well, go ahead. The program you're using right now is this one, and the source code is here. And I'll even help you find the part of the source code that relates to this problem so that you can start learning. And the next thing the student will do is say, you know, I don't think this program is exactly right. I'd like to try changing it. With non-free software, you're helpless. Non-free software keeps you helpless. That's what it means that it's non-free. You can't study it or change it. With free software, you can change it. The teachers can guide the students until the students don't need any more guidance because they'll learn. They'll learn to be, by the time they graduate from secondary school, they can be accomplished, capable programmers, capable of taking a job to do powerful programs. I've seen this happen plenty of times. But the deepest reason applies to every student. Schools are supposed to do more than just teach facts and skills. The most important thing for schools to teach is a good attitude towards other people, an attitude of cooperating with other people, helping them out when they need help. So schools should say to the young students, to the kids when they first come to school, if you bring software to school, you can't keep it for yourself. You must give copies to the other kids when they want copies. Of course, the school has to practice its own rule. It has to practice what it preaches. So the school should supply only free software to these kids. And that will teach them good habits of living, habits of sharing with other people. If I had a child who was in school, and the school started trying to teach my child not to share with other people, I would tell the teachers, don't you dare say that to my child. I want my child to be a helpful, kind, cooperating person. Don't you dare say that sharing is wrong. You know what they say? They say that if you share with other people, you're a pirate. They're saying, when they use that word, what they mean is that helping your neighbor is morally equivalent to attacking ships. And that is the opposite of morality. Attacking ships is very bad. Sharing with your neighbor is good, and we should all encourage other people to share with our neighbors. And anyone who says that sharing with your neighbor is piracy, we have to say loud and clear that they are wrong. So I will now let you go. Unfortunately, I have no way to accept questions. I'm sure there would be many questions after a speech like this. But such is life. I can't do it now. So happy hacking, and let's all keep moving forward for freedom.